After decades of research, finally a big breakthrough on Ebola.
Having now two drugs, which are highly effective, I think is a huge advance in the treatment of this very, very difficult disease.
How these treatments are a game changer for areas stricken with Ebola. Also today, a Hindu saint who has hugged 39 million people. She's brought her embrace from India to the U.S.
For that brief, singular moment in time, you are a child being held by a divine mother.
And a Washington art museum tried to advertise an exhibit about refugees, but the Metro said no.
I was very upset. Because I didn't see this as a political statement. I couldn't understand why they didn't want to advertise it.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and much more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We begin today's show with some very good news about a bad news story. Some of the happiest recipients of the news are in the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
Aujourd'hui, nous avons commencé une nouvelle étape.
That's Dr. Jean-Jacques Muyembe in the DRC, stating that Ebola is no longer incurable. He was speaking to reporters on a conference call from the DRC. Muyembe has been working on treating the deadly virus since the 1970s. This week he said that new advances will save thousands of lives. He and others were testing four drugs. Two were so good that they halted the rest of the trials. Dr. Anthony Fauci is director of the National Institute of Allergies and Infectious Diseases here in the U.S. and also oversaw these trials.
This is a very important advance. Prior to this, we really did not have any adequate direct therapy aimed at decreasing the mortality of patients with Ebola virus disease.
So, Dr. Fauci, how are you feeling today?
Oh, well, you know, I feel very good. We started on developing this drug in collaboration with Professor Muyembe a very long time ago. The antibody was derived from a Congolese patient who we saw in the Congo in 1995 during an outbreak in Kitwit. And in collaboration with Dr. Muyembe, we developed this monoclonal antibody here at the National Institutes of Health from that patient, which has now gone full circle and gone back to the DRC to help people. So that's a really good story that makes us all feel good.
And by antibody, you mean somebody who had Ebola but then recovered?
Yeah, when the body in the normal state gets exposed to a pathogen like Ebola, it makes antibodies, which are natural body proteins that ultimately neutralize the virus and get rid of the virus from the body. So the strategy for these drugs is to artificially make an antibody the same as the antibody that's made in the normal body, make a lot of it, and put it in a form that can be passively infused into a person who's sick with Ebola. So essentially, you're giving that person a lot of what their body would optimally make to stop the virus.
So that's a great outcome, but I imagine people have very mixed feelings about being test subjects during a life or death situation. I mean, the former health minister of the DRC resigned over debates around whether to try out a second experimental vaccine. People want drugs that'll help them. So I have to ask you, how do you ethically do a trial during an outbreak?
Well, we don't know what works. So you can't say you're withholding a drug that works. You're trying to find out as quickly as you possibly can, which is the best of these drugs. You're not giving somebody nothing. And as soon as you find out which is the best drug, then you stop the trial and give everybody the best drug.
So we know Ebola is incredibly infectious. The latest outbreak has killed at least 1,800 people in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. But there's civil conflict, there's security problems, there's mistrust. How do you get these drugs deployed in the middle of this conflict zone? All these problems are still there.
It is not easy, and that's the reason why this was such an amazing accomplishment to be able to not only conduct a trial in the middle of an outbreak, but to do it in a way that you get a meaningful answer. It was dangerous. Several of the people who were involved in the Ebola treatment units were actually either wounded or even killed because of the violence. So it was done, but it was done in a way under very difficult security conditions. One of the things that we hope that now that when the people realize that we do have an effective therapy for them, they will be much more likely to come into the clinics early and get treatment that would save their lives.
So the clinical trials were called POM. Explain that.
Well, it comes from three Swahili words that are the inspiration for the study. So it's called Pamoja Tulinda Mashi, and it's a Swahili word which means together save lives.
Well, very appropriate. Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institutes of Allergies and Infectious Diseases, overseeing this trial. It's good to hear this news. Thank you for explaining what it means.
Good to be with you.
Here's what we know. There was a deadly nuclear accident in Russia last Thursday. At least 5 people were killed. The explosion took place near or possibly on the White Sea in the Russian north, and it involved a secret missile project. We're also confident that the accident is not anywhere close to the scale of Chernobyl, but there are similarities, a lack of information and a cover-up, as occurred more than 3 decades ago under the Soviets. Today in Russia, there remains considerable confusion about exactly what happened and concerns about who may still be at risk. Moscow-based reporter Charles Maines has been trying to get to the bottom of it all. So what have you found so far, Charles?
Well, we know from Russia's nuclear energy agency, it's called Rosatom here, that 5 nuclear specialists died after, and let me quote here, small-scale sources of energy with the use of fissile materials exploded during an experiment in the White Sea on August 8th. So in other words, it's a small nuclear reactor that detonated in Russia's Arctic waters last week. It's just the extent and scale of which that are still not clear.
Yes, yeah, so small-scale sources of energy. That sounds like equivocation.
It does. And the problem here is that this story has really dripped out since August 8th with a lot of contradictory information. In fact, that was the main takeaway I had from a conversation with Andrei Zolotkov. He's the longtime head of Bellona, an international environmental monitoring group here in Russia. Andrei heads their Russia division.
Ой, мне много чего известно.
You know, and he says his head is just kind of overloaded from all the speculation and different versions that have come out, depending on who you talk to about what happened on August 8th. You know, Russia's military initially said a rocket engine had exploded near a ballistic missile test site on land, killing 2 civilians. Then Russia's nuclear energy agency said the incident occurred at sea. Then we heard that it was not 2 people, but indeed 5. And that these nuclear specialists had acted heroically and saved us from some bigger nuclear accident, although it's not entirely clear just how big. But Zolotkov, he raises another point.
Где теперь это устройство находится? То есть находится ли оно под контролем или оно...
He says, where is this device now? Is it in the military's possession? Did it fly off somewhere or maybe sink into the sea? You know, where is it? That's something that nobody's saying anything about at this point.
So that's one mystery. There is a spike in radiation. So, I mean, aside from people who sadly died from this, is anyone else at risk?
Well, that's another source of confusion. The military insisted radiation levels remain normal, in other words, unchanged after the incident. Local officials reported elevated levels and then took that information down from their website. And in fact, today, Russia's state weather agency confirmed a spike in readings up to 16 times the norm in Severodvinsk. That's got a population of almost 200,000, and it's the main center near the test site.
So what's been the reaction from the local population? Are they taking precautions?
Well, you know, again, we also heard contradictory reports today about a possible evacuation from the Ninotska test site, apparently because of military exercises. I was told that that's sort of a standard thing there, but it was called off. In other words, authorities say this would have been routine, but they're not going through with it. But that doesn't mean people aren't worried. Now, through a scratchy telephone line, I reached a local journalist in Severodvinsk, a guy named Alexei Redford, who said that locals were, of course, concerned. In fact, they bought up all the iodine from local drugstores, iodine, of course, being thought to help against radiation poisoning. He also said, you know, some people had left the area, but mostly life was kind of moving along as usual. Kids outside, people walking their dogs, that kind of thing. One additional precaution he said that people were taking, that apparently nobody is jogging or going for, you know, sporting events along the cliffs of the White Sea as they normally would during the summer months, because, of course, they don't have much of a summer up in the north.
Yeah. Charles, there's a lot of speculation that this accident was related to Russia's military, that this was a weapons test, some kind of secret missile project. What do you know about that?
Well, that's right. This accident occurred at what's considered a closed area in Russia. It's the missile test center. U.S. nuclear experts think this was a test gone wrong of a weapon called the Burevestnik, Skyfall in English, a nuclear-powered missile that President Putin has unveiled last year as a key part of Russia's new arsenal in a speech he gave. So again, it's worth emphasizing that this weapon is or was not secret, so much so that state media bragged about it openly. You know, Burevestnik supposedly has this nuclear-powered engine that can circle the globe near endlessly while it seeks out its target. And it was, you know, promoted as a symbol of Russia gaining the upper hand against the U.S. in nuclear technology.
По количеству предложений рекордсменом стала крылатая ракета с ядерной энергетической установкой. Больше 100,000 разных идей.
You know, in fact, at Putin's request, last year Russia held a public naming contest for the weapon, with Burevestnik beating out Surprise for Palmyra and Ash. And, you know, Marco, I also want to point out here that the U.S., in fact, did play with this technology back in the 70s, only decided it was just way too risky.
So Skyfall was a crowdsourced name?
It was.
Wow. Reporter Charles Maines in Moscow, thanks as always.
Thanks, Marco.
Trade deals between nations can take years to construct, end up being thousands of pages long. And just when it looks like the deal is done, when all the negotiating and haggling is over, the agreement can hit an unexpected snag. When the U.S. and Canada were renegotiating NAFTA last year, a final sticking point came down to milk. It almost torpedoed the revised agreement. Australia and the European Union are now hammering out their own trade deal. Trade officials were optimistic that this deal was a slam dunk, a win-win for both parties. But negotiations have suddenly turned stinky. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports.
Any good negotiator will tell you compromise is key. You gotta give a little to get a little. But everyone has their limits, and apparently for the Europeans, that limit is cheese. Or cheese names, to be more exact. Europe wants to prevent Australian cheesemakers from using names like feta, gruyere, and gorgonzola. Australian Trade Minister Simon Birmingham circulated a list with hundreds of food names. These are names the EU wants protected as part of a free trade agreement. Birmingham told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that he was prepared to drive a hard bargain.
We've made no promises to the EU in terms of giving up any names. Overall, this deal has to be in the best interests of Australia.
The EU argues that names like feta, manchego, Roquefort are tied to specific regions in Europe, and they shouldn't be used by producers in other countries. Kind of like the intellectual property of food. In trade speak, these names are called geographical indications, or GIs. Veronica Nye is an economist at the American Farm Bureau Lobbying Group. And she says we do this in the U.S. for things like Washington State apples or Idaho potatoes, but no one claims GI status quite as often as the Europeans.
They've used it for lots of cheeses, meats, beers, and lots of other food.
The Europeans are also known for trying to enforce those protections in trade agreements, to which countries like Australia and the U.S., for that matter, say, come on.
From the U.S. perspective, things like Parmesan have become a common food name, that in fact there's at least as much Parmesan cheese and feta cheese that's made outside of the EU than within it. From the European side, they'd say, well, that's not our fault that it's become generic, that we haven't done a good job enforcing it. And that's really where the world kind of sits at this point.
Australian producers now have 3 months to review the EU's list of protected food names. In the meantime, EU officials have some advice. Farmers Secretary General Pekka Pesonen told the Australian Broadcasting Company that Australians should start brainstorming. They need some creative new names for feta. Finland had to do it.
Being a Finn, we also saw the same obstacles, the same challenge. It wasn't very easy, I have to admit, but then we did.
And for all you inquiring minds out there, the Finnish name for feta is now salad cheese. For the World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Just ahead, a museum in Washington wanted to advertise its exhibit on refugees. The Metro said, not with us. You're with the World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with the World. Since 1949, the Indian state of Kashmir has operated on its own. India's constitution gave India's only Muslim-majority state near autonomy. Basically, the state could govern itself. This lasted 70 years, but last week, the Indian government removed Kashmir's special status, giving New Delhi much more control over the territory. India did not consult with Pakistan before doing it, and the two nations have fought wars over the disputed parts of Kashmir. So the latest move has thrown Kashmir into panic and raised questions about the relationship between India and Pakistan. Rick Olson is a former U.S. ambassador to Pakistan, a post he held from 2012 to 2015. Ambassador, help us understand the relationship between Pakistan and India and how that plays into what's happening in Kashmir right now.
It has been a contentious relationship between India and Pakistan since the establishment of the two countries in 1947. They have fought four wars, at least three of which were pretty directly related to the question of Kashmir. Kashmir is a Muslim majority state. In 1947, it was a principality, a Muslim majority principality, and there was an expectation on the part of Pakistan that it would come into Pakistan as a Muslim majority state. What happened is the Maharaja chose to align with India, and that has been a bone of contention between the two countries ever since.
India and Pakistan, we got to remember, are both nuclear powers. That must also add to the challenge.
Well, absolutely. And this is why the stakes are so high for, amongst others, the United States, but really for the whole world, because you have two nuclear powers that are eyeball to eyeball. I mean, they are literally adjoining each other. It's unlike the Cold War when the U.S. and the USSR were at least separated by oceans and had a bit of time before missiles would be launched. Things can really get out of control very quickly on the subcontinent.
Is there an opening for international intervention here? Should the U.S. try to mediate, as President Trump kind of offered in passing to Imran Khan of Pakistan?
Well, the problem with this is a classic mediation would not work because a classic mediation requires both parties to agree to the terms of a mediation. And India has made clear that it does not see a role for international mediation. Now, I think the role for the United States, which it has traditionally played, is to, in times of crises, help to de-escalate and to help both sides using its good offices to find a way out of going a step further in an escalatory conflict. And I think, unfortunately, I think that will probably be a role that the United States will probably have to continue to play and should play.
Ambassador, pull back for a moment, because the U.S. has been deeply engaged in this part of the world since 9/11. Kashmir, though, often not the first consideration, but now it seems to be more in the center. With Afghanistan-Pakistan's strategy, there was often a blue sky belief that maybe there's a grand bargain to be had. Is that still possible, some deal that would give everyone in the region something and leverage like the diplomatic muscle of a country like India? Or is it too late for that, given India's muscular intentions in Kashmir?
Well, I think that it's going to be remains to be seen how it's going to play out in terms of the Afghan negotiations. The peace process between the U.S. and the Taliban is pretty actively going forward. Pakistan has played a helpful role in that regard, and I think one of the questions will be going forward is whether Pakistan insists on a greater role for the U.S. with regard to India in exchange for its cooperation on Afghanistan.
Rick Olson, U.S. Ambassador to Pakistan from 2012 to 15. Thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.
An art museum in Washington has an exhibition up right now on migration and the refugee crisis, controversial topics, as you know, on Capitol Hill. And when the museum tried to promote the show, there were questions about whether it's making a humanitarian statement or a political one. Here's WAMU's Michaela Lafrak in Washington.
The exhibition is something of a departure for the Phillips Collection in D.C. The museum is best known for its impressionist and modernist paintings by European masters like Renoir and Picasso. But this summer, it's been transformed. Three floors of gallery space are devoted to an exhibition called The Warmth of Other Suns, Stories of Global Displacement.
So on many levels, it was very ambitious.
Chief Curator Klaus Ottmann put the exhibition together with two guest curators from New York's New Museum. It features more than 100 works by 75 artists from around the world. Ottmann shows me an installation playing two videos.
Each shows children walking into the water, carrying little boats that they made out of shoes.
One was filmed on the Spanish side of the Strait of Gibraltar, the other on the Moroccan side. It's hard to tell if the children are screaming with joy or fear as they get farther into the water.
Obviously, it references the boat people.
Last year, more than 2,200 people drowned trying to cross the Mediterranean to reach Europe.
People get very emotional. Well, I've seen people crying.
That's Danny Levinas, chairman of the Phillips Board and a champion of the exhibition. He's an immigrant himself from Argentina. He defended the exhibition in a Washington Post op-ed after the D.C. Transit Agency rejected an ad campaign for it in the spring. Metro cited its rule prohibiting ads intended to influence public policy.
I was very upset because I didn't see this as a political statement. I couldn't understand why they didn't want to advertise it.
But earlier this month, Metro reversed its decision, offering no explanation. A spokesman declined to comment. The Phillips director, Dorothy Kaczynski, says at this point, the museum has already used the money it was going to spend on the Metro ads. But she says she welcomes the reversal.
There's nothing in the world that isn't political. You know, and it's kind of an illusion if a cultural institution thinks that they're neutral.
The Phillips dug into its own collection for the exhibition. One touchstone is Jacob Lawrence's Migration series. His colorful paintings document the great migration of African Americans from south to north in the first half of the 20th century. The curators hung them next to works by contemporary black artists. Another permanent exhibit features work by the abstract expressionist Mark Rothko, who immigrated to the U.S. from Russia. Rothko's paintings are now shown next to everyday objects found on the U.S.-Mexico border, like an embroidered cloth and pair of shoes. Kaczynski hopes these juxtapositions help people connect the different chapters of the refugee experience.
I hope what this exhibit provides, the sense of awakening empathy, a visceral and emotional encounter with real people, rather than reading headlines and numbers and statistics.
She takes me into one final room to see an installation by French artist Kader Atia. Clothes in different shades of blue are strewn all over the floor.
It's an interesting installation. It's so simple. You know, it's just shirts and shoes and pants and socks. But there's this there's something very visceral about it.
It looks like the ocean and feels like loss. It'll be on view as part of the exhibition through late September. For The World, Michaela Lafrak, Washington, D.C.
I'm Marco Werman. Megachurches, the concept does not sit well with all evangelicals.
Buildings, butts, and bucks.
Butts and seats?
Butts and seats.
You know. What's not impressive about that to you?
Well, there's no place in Scripture where God says, you know what, I value lots of property.
Moving beyond butts and bucks, ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, PRI, and PRX. Today, we continue looking at the changing face of evangelical Christianity in America. We begin today's story talking about money. It's easy to conjure up the image of a televangelist dressed to the nines and flying around in a private jet to spread the good word. Earlier this year, this video made the rounds.
To those critics that say that a preacher should not be living a life of luxury, what is your response to that?
They're wrong.
That was reporter Lisa Guerrero from Inside Edition putting Pastor Kenneth Copeland on the spot. He owns at least three private jets. Copeland once said flying commercial is like getting into a long tube with a bunch of demons. Copeland isn't the only pastor who's been criticized for getting rich, but today we're going to hear about a church that's making a pretty radical shift away from what's been called the gospel of prosperity. The World's Matthew Bell and religion scholar Heather Melquist-Leto have the story.
Francis Chan is a well-known evangelical pastor from California. He says the problem with the prosperity preachers is that they miss something fundamental in the Bible. It's that Jesus warns against idolizing wealth, and that, like Jesus, faithful Christians may have lives that are full of suffering.
What's awful about the prosperity gospel is it's saying your life is going to be completely different. I promise you, it'll be completely different from what Christ went through. You're going to be healthy, you're going to be wealthy, the people are going to love you. And it really sets people up for failure in a lot of ways.
Chan wrote best-selling books, and he built a hugely successful megachurch. But at its height, he left to start something very different. It's called We Are Church. It's sort of the anti-prosperity gospel side of evangelical Christianity.
By the numbers, We Are Church isn't big. It's made up of about 20 house churches. Each one includes about 10 to 15 adults.
But even if those numbers don't sound impressive, We Are Church is well known. In fact, I first heard about it from Christians in South Korea while I was doing research there.
American church leaders are impressed, too. Christians from all over are traveling to San Francisco to learn more and to meet people like Kevin Kim. He's a founding member of We Are Church. Kim grew up in Virginia, and he says, of course, he went to church with his parents, who came to the U.S. from Korea. Today, almost two-thirds of Korean Americans go to church regularly, and often for more than just religious reasons.
If you're Korean and you come to the States, you have to join a church in order to survive, right?
Because it's sort of a social network.
A social network. Like, how do you figure stuff out? How do you find a good lawyer, mechanic? How do you try to understand where you're at? And how do you, you know, find friendships? You join the local Korean church.
After college, Kim went on to become a preacher at a mega church in Silicon Valley. But he left that job to help create We Are Church, whose leaders measure success very differently than many evangelical churches.
The traditional metrics of church success are buildings, butts, and bucks.
Butts in seats?
Butts in seats, and then bucks. So,
What's not impressive about that to you?
Well, there's no place in Scripture where God says, you know what I value? Here's what I value. I value, like, lots of property. Or I value, like, just sheer numbers.
We Are Church decided early on they wouldn't have buildings or paid clergy. Kim says they're focused on biblical values, not things like the size of the congregation they're growing.
In your group of 10,000 people, how well do they love one another? And how well do they love the world and their community? And how much do they pray? And how, like, do we even care about those metrics? Or are we just satisfied that we got, you know, 10,000 people? Because if that was it, if that's what God wanted, we just want 10,000 people, then, hey, you know what? I can do that. I can get Justin Bieber or Beyonce to open up, and I can get 10,000 people. That cannot be the metric.
So here's where the house church model comes in. The members of We Are Church gather in people's homes, where they hold religious services and Bible study. One of the intentions here is to bring people closer together, perhaps radically so. Kim says the group prides itself on building house churches whose members might be very different from each other. For example, one of the house churches is co-led by a former Mexican gang leader and a Silicon Valley web developer.
Your ability to be hospitable, your ability to be generous, your ability to love is something that can grow, right? And it grows better when those things are challenged in really diverse communities, you know, across gender, experience, race, upbringing, values.
Kim says that this can make things more difficult. But that's the point. He says that people need to practice building relationships with people they may not even like. The idea is to prioritize diversity over catering to the personal interests of church members. That's another way We Are Church operates as a sort of critique of evangelical megachurches.
I don't know if you can get to this place of biblical love without the sanctifying process of being vulnerable and wronged and challenged. I don't think you can get there.
The intentions all sound well and good, but for some people, it's asking too much. For example, the role of women in leadership has been contentious. During a drive through the city, Kevin Kim explains that We Are Church does not allow women to become pastors or hold the title of elder. That's based on a conservative reading of Scripture that says men and women should have different roles. Do you ever get arguments from your female leaders about this?
We have had people leave because of it.
Being in We Are Church, like any community, requires some compromise. Kim says this is a tough issue for him personally, because he thinks there are good arguments based on the Bible, both for and against women serving as pastors. For some people, this view of gender roles is a deal breaker. But for others who might disagree, the issue isn't significant enough to drive them away from a church that they believe is otherwise living out Christian values, especially their uncompromising commitment to material generosity.
It's not just the unpaid pastors who practice austerity. Members are also asked to share resources more than at a typical church. In an expensive city like San Francisco, where people struggle to afford housing, church members might even open their homes to one another.
We're not this commune where, like, everybody lives together, but we are this community where, like, one of the practices is to share our possessions. And if, you know, we have a car that you need, or we have a place where you can stay and you need it, the expectation is that you would meet that need.
Kim says this frees up church money for more important things like overseas missions and local programs in San Francisco.
To show us a real-world example of what We Are Church is doing in the community, Kevin takes us to Huli Huli Hawaiian Restaurant. It was opened by the church in one of the rougher areas of San Francisco.
This is our restaurant right here. Don't leave anything in your car, in my car. You will get my windows broken and you'll have your stuff stolen. So we take everything out.
68. The look of the restaurant is simple. A few island decorations, the smell of Kahlua pork, and there are no obvious signs that it's really a church ministry. Here's where we met Kevin Shedden, another church elder, who explained the real mission here.
Most of our employees here are coming in from difficult situations, so homelessness, addiction, jail, rehab, and they live in our men's and women's home. So that's the first layer. The second layer is that you won't see that we donate. We take some of the revenue that comes in, and we donate to a local nonprofit in the neighborhood. And then we also donate to a ministry in Ethiopia as well that are taking women out of the red light district and feeding kids that are literally a day from starving. So we send some of our revenue over there as well.
All that might be impossible if We Are Church had a church building to maintain and pastors on the payroll. So what does it mean to be an evangelical Christian today? We ask Shedden that question, and he says he doesn't get caught up in the label.
Broadly, if you were to look at what people think of when they hear of evangelical Christians, I think they would probably think of like white suburbia, Republican, George W. Bush, Donald Trump.
Pro-life. Against gay marriage.
Yeah, against gay marriage, all of those things. Some of it's true, but I think a lot of it too, like people aren't seeing like the love for the poor and the marginalized and the oppressed and Jesus's desire for justice.
Shedden says the idea that Christianity is about politics or power is off the mark. He hasn't bothered to vote in a presidential election since 2000, and he worries that many of his fellow evangelical Christians are getting distracted by politics.
They're looking to the Trump or the Obama or the Hillary as the savior. Jesus is the savior.
In presenting their dramatically different model of what an evangelical church looks like, We Are Church has earned a reputation for being a disruptor. It seems to have a lot of fans. Kevin Kim reminded us, though, that creating buzz is not the real goal.
It's not that we're like trying to intentionally pop the status quo for the sake of like being contrarian. Like that's not the goal. The goal is the high fidelity to Scripture and taking what God says seriously about the church and not just paying lip service to it.
For Kevin Kim and We Are Church, that just doesn't include much political activism. In our story tomorrow, we'll hear from a Christian couple who are all about engaging with the politics of today.
Which is, I think, why
Hood Politics is such a hit for our podcast, you know, where we break down politics, basically saying, like, if you don't understand gang life, you understand politics, because it's basically the same thing. It's just dudes, but they have fancier cars, fancier suits, and more money, but it's the same thing.
Prop and the Doc is what they call themselves. That story tomorrow. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
And I'm Heather Melquist-Leto.
Our series is a collaboration with the Sacred Rights Project at Northeastern University, supported by the Henry Luce Foundation. There's a famous saint in India. She's known by her followers as Amma. Those followers see Amma as an incarnation of a god. She is one of the first women to become a Hindu saint. And her saintly offering, a hug. An estimated 39 million people worldwide have gotten hugged by Amma. She brought her embrace to the U.S. recently and added the world's Amanda Lee Lichtenstein to her list.
There was so much anticipation. I felt a little anxious, to be honest. I didn't quite know what the rules were. Luckily, someone handed out a laminated sheet of instructions before you go up.
So there are rules.
There is a huge team of people on stage making sure that you don't break the rules and that you do get it right. So you have to take off your shoes. You have to make sure when you go that you kneel to her. So you are kneeling before Amma as a living goddess. And as you kneel down, you are to place each hand on either side, firmly on either side of her body on the chair. And then her attendants surround you behind you and gently kind of push your face into her bosom and kind of they nestle you into her chest. And that's the moment, Marco, that is the moment when Amma herself does embrace you and kind of envelops you in a motherly embrace. And for that brief singular moment in time, you are a child being held by a divine mother. And it is so brief, so brief.
My skin is kind of tingling. I mean, what does she look like? How old is she?
She's in her mid-60s, and she has a warm kind of glow to her. She's a plump, round woman, small in stature. She wears a signature white sari. What I remember so much about the hug, Marco, is that she had this amazing scent, this rose-scented fragrance that kind of lingered on my clothes after I was pulled from her chest, kind of yanked away from her, because there are several hundred more people waiting behind me. So the hug was kind of a blur and very, a bit disorienting and quite moving. And then it was over.
How did it feel, though? And can you today, I mean, this is like a couple of weeks after the hug, can you still conjure it?
To be honest, I went in there with a critical eye. I introduced myself as part of the press. I introduced myself as a journalist. I was there to observe and take notes. And the hug itself was so moving. I was taken aback. The actual hug was such a relief after waiting so long. I had so much anxiety about like getting the rules right and wanting to make sure, you know, you don't want to get it wrong when you're hugging God, right? So I wanted to make sure. I wanted to make sure that I was following the rules and that I wasn't going to mess this up kind of feeling. And then the actual hug was such a relief and made me feel so vulnerable and so moved. And the idea of this universal mother embracing me and unconditionally accepting me, and for that brief moment, feeling what it feels like to be like a child again, that to me was not something that I really expected or signed up for or knew I would feel in such a deep way.
The world's Amanda Lee Lichtenstein with her account of getting hugged by Amma, a Hindu hugging saint. Amanda, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Marco. It was fun to chat with you.
So what happens when thousands of people gather in an Illinois town to hug a saint? It can transform the place. Read Amanda's story about one town's experience with Amma at theworld.org. The news from Venezuela has been bad for years. The country's economy is in a virtual free fall, and the politics are a mess. And now the situation there appears to be getting worse. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro is threatening to take an extraordinary step to dissolve the country's parliament, the National Assembly. One of the lawmakers who could be out of a job is Juan Andres Mejia, whose parliamentary immunity has already been revoked. Mejia is in the U.S., basically in exile. I asked how he lost his immunity and why he was here.
The Supreme Court
decided to rule against me and my colleagues, saying we had committed treason, we had committed rebellion, usurpation of power, instigation. And I decided to go into hiding in Venezuela because at the same day, on May 8th, that my sentence was published, Congressman Zambrano, the vice president of the National Assembly, was detained and taken into prison where he is today. Still, there hasn't been a procedure. There hasn't been anything legal around that detention. So I decided to go into hiding for more than 2 months in Venezuela. And a few weeks ago, I decided to leave the country in order to be able to raise my voice again. And I hope I can come back soon, but it's difficult for me to do that if I don't want to be detained.
I was going to say, if you had stayed in Venezuela, what's the likelihood that you would be in prison right now?
So Congressman Zambrano decided to stay. He went to his office one day, and he was surrounded by the police. He decided to stay inside his car, and he started to tweet that he was being surrounded by the police. Since he refused to get out of his car, they decided to tow his car with him inside.
Wow.
And they took his car and him into prison, and he's been there for 3 months, as I was saying. So that's a reality of hundreds of Venezuelans who are, it's fair to say, political prisoners.
So now Nicolas Maduro has threatened to essentially shut down the legislature and hold new elections. Is that legal?
It's absolutely illegal. It's unconstitutional. And it also threatens the will of the people. The National Assembly was elected 4 years ago by more than 15 million Venezuelans.
So the announcement about the shutdown, the possible shutdown of the National Assembly, was supposed to happen yesterday, but it didn't. What happened instead?
Well, yesterday, more colleagues had their immunity taken away by an illegal procedure. They've been slowly taking deputies out of their seats. As you can see, this is a strategy by the Maduro regime, who's only concerned about remaining in power no matter the constitution.
Nicolas Maduro, though, despite what some people say, was elected and is still president. So, I mean, how do you negotiate that?
Well, the fact that you pretend to have an election does not mean you were elected. The UK, most European countries, most Latin American countries, we're talking about more than 50 countries around the world, did not recognize last year's elections as free and fair elections. So what we're demanding now is to have a free and fair election so that the people of Venezuela can decide what they want for the future.
As far as this latest threat by Maduro to shut down the National Assembly, will he be challenged on that, either internally or externally, and how would that happen?
Well, I think he doesn't have the support to do that yet, but he is more than willing to do so. I mean, regardless that they were going through the worst economic and social crisis, he refuses to leave office. This is what the international community should take into account. This is the basic agreement that we should have, that no person in the world should be the barrier to progress.
Juan Andres Mejia, a deputy in Venezuela's National Assembly, now essentially in exile in the United States. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
You know what's really bad for the environment? Flying. Planes generate a lot of greenhouse gases that contribute to climate change. So when the United Nations convened a summit in New York of world leaders to discuss climate change, one 16-year-old woman in Europe said, you know what, I'll skip the plane. I'll sail to New York instead. The BBC's chief environment correspondent, Justin Rowlett, met with Greta Thunberg and got a chance to check out the racing yacht that will transport her across the Atlantic to the summit.
Sailing the boat. Whoa, we're going about. Whoa, cramped. We're sailing the boat that's going to take Greta Thunberg to New York, and it is a brutal experience. The Militia is basically just a huge sail attached to a super light carbon fiber hull, and it skitters and crashes through the waves. It's a rough ride, and it is very, very wet. I've only been on here for a few minutes, and I'll tell you what, I'm not sure I could take 2 weeks of this.
But Greta Thunberg says she is not worried.
I feel a bit seasick, and it's not going to be comfortable, but that I can live with.
But look, if we're honest, and you've said this yourself before, one person giving up flying doesn't make any difference in a world of 8 billion people. So what is the point?
The point, I think, is to sort of create an opinion. By stop flying, you don't only reduce your own carbon footprint, but also that sense a signal to other people around you.
The Swedish 16-year-old began her climate protests almost exactly a year ago, skipping school on Fridays to sit alone outside the Swedish Parliament building. She prompted a worldwide wave of climate strikes and, along the way, became an international celebrity. But there are no concessions to comfort on the boat. No shower, no kitchen, no refrigerator, no heating, and no toilet. You do your business in a bright blue bucket. Greta is going to New York to attend a UN climate summit of world leaders. She says she hopes to persuade them urgent action is needed.
It's important all the time, but especially now, since there has been scientific studies show that around the year 2020, the emission curve must have been bended down if we are to have a chance to stay below the 1.5 or 2 degrees of warming limit. And what we are doing now is to say that we demand that you take your responsibility and do something. I mean, our job is to demand solutions, not to provide solutions. All we are saying is listen to the science and the experts in these areas.
The Militia generates its own electricity from solar panels on deck and two turbines that can be lowered from the stern. It will be a tough journey, but, says Greta, it is the most environmentally friendly way she could find to make it, and it will be quick.
If it's really hard, then I just have to think it's only for 2 weeks. Then I can go back to as usual.
Greta Thunberg expects to arrive in New York at the end of August.
The BBC's Justin Rowlett. That is the world for this Tuesday. Ned Porter composed our theme music from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios here at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for listening. We're back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.